Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited because this week we're talking Kong Skull Island, so I am joined by the biggest monkey I know, JB. He's beating his chest.
Excitement and adventure. It's a long boat journey that begins tomorrow morning.
We're going to be talking spoiler-free about Kong Skull Island.
For about 5 minutes.
A title I hate. I wish they had just... When they announced it, it was just Skull Island. And then someone in marketing, I'm sure, panicked and said, but then people won't know it's King Kong. So now it has the nonsensical title, because it's not even Kong colon Skull Island.
Oh.
It's just like...
Because everything seems to be colon now.
The island is named after Kong Skull, maybe? Is that the full... He shortened King Kong
like,
Skull to just like King Kong.
That sounds like a location in the old He-Man.
He couldn't
Masters of the Universe
spell
cartoon.
It correctly on his immigration papers, so
We're
he just
going to Kong Skull
made his mark. And
before Kong Skulls and Islands together again, we saw the trailer for Alien
Covenant.
Now, does that have a colon?
I think so. Covenant is the name of the ship, I think.
Everything has
a colon.
A colon.
Yeah.
And as I was watching the trailer for Alien Covenant, I was thinking of our award-winning podcast on Prometheus, where you start out and you have great intentions and the film turns to dust in your hands.
Some footage from Covenant I know screened at South by Southwest this weekend or is screening. I haven't read any reactions yet. Obviously, I'm going to see the movie and am... sort of excited because I like that world, but it's alien. Like, how many times can we do the movie where we land on the planet and then there's eggs and then there's a facehugger and then there are aliens, and every time we have to be surprised?
Well, that's part of give the people what they want, and I have something to say about give the people what they want.
Okay.
But first, you should say, what have you seen
lately?
Well,
right, yes. Before we talk about what we've seen lately, quick shout-outs to the people who've donated to F This Movie this week. Timothy Smedland, John Murphy, Gabby Farrow, thank you very much for your donations to FThisMovie.net. Jay Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, you pretty much exhausted yourselves talking about Logan twice in a row for the podcast, and I just had something very tiny to add about Logan.
Go for it.
Because that's what I've seen lately. I really liked it. I think at one point in the podcast you said, I'm not quoting, I'm trying to remember the exact wording, but I'm going to come up short, that we judge these things as comic book movies, and occasionally they reach a stage where we could judge them as an actual movie. And I agree about Logan, and I've been saying forever and ever to my students who are obsessed with comic book movies that if I'm not that interested in comic books or not that interested in robots fighting, I'm looking for the point where the superhero part becomes a metaphor for something else. And I may have said this before on the podcast.
Maybe.
That in the first Bryan Singer X-Men,
yes,
there's a bar fight, and after the bar fight, Rogue and Logan are riding in his pickup truck, and there's a long silence, and Rogue says, does it hurt when they come out? And he says, every time. And suddenly, your brain explodes, because this isn't about superheroes, this is about something that's endemic to the human condition. I've said the same thing about Spider-Man 2. Doc Ock, I will not die a monster. And the same can be said of Logan. And I think you guys were debating over Logan's last line, but doesn't he tell her not to become what they made her?
Yes.
So another wonderful message that Logan shares with Ratatouille, don't let other people define you,
right,
which is a fine message for our contemporary day. But here's the last word on Logan, and I wanted to bring this up in the podcast because I want credit for this. Because somebody that's good at Photoshop needs to turn this into a meme. In Alien Covenant, it seems like they're just going through the paces of Alien again because we want to give the people what they want. And though I loved Logan and think it's a really, really great film, I think there's a degree of that going on in Logan, too, in that if people like Wolverine, okay, we're going to give them Wolverine and Baby Wolverine and Big Bad Wolverine, A24. And
X-24.
I'm sorry, my bad. I'm thinking of the studio that makes superior films.
He gets attacked by a bunch of pretentious artists.
A bunch of producers looking for the next big thing. So I'm driving home after seeing it, and I'm thinking this is a really good example of give the public what they want. And it suddenly occurred to me that the makers of Logan and the fine McDonald's Corporation have the same basic strategy. People like Wolverine. People like the Big Mac. So what should we do? We're going to give them the Mac Jr., which is baby Wolverine, and the Grande Mac, which is the big bad Wolverine. How do you like that?
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Pick your size.
To James Mangold's credit, I think in Wolverine, each of those iterations of Wolverine serves a thematic function. It isn't just like, here's more Wolverine for your buck.
Sure. And having tasted all three of the sandwiches that I just referenced.
I have not. I'm not a Big Mac guy.
Mac Jr.? Yeah. Okay in a pinch. Very hard to eat in the car. Grande Mac? Don't even think.
What's the story with Grande Mac?
It's really big and it will stop your heart.
How many is it, like two Big Macs smashed together?
No, it's...
I don't understand.
Don't think higher. Think wider.
Oh, really?
Bigger bun, bigger patty. It's harder to hold. Not a fan. Speaking of McDonald's, I went to see The Founder.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
I have not.
It was good, not great, and I think here's the reason. The two gentlemen who wrote Ed Wood and later The People versus Larry Flint had this talent for making really, I think they did Man in the Moon, too. I think
they
that
did.
Was their triumvirate of biopics.
And they worked on that OJ show on FX.
Oh.
Yeah.
See, they have a talent, and this goes back to what I was saying about Logan, of making it about what it's about,
right,
but also
right.
something else. The Founder lacks that. So it's good. Its recreation of the past is very nice to look at. Kept wondering if they had visited the original McDonald's, which is by our houses. And Michael Keaton just tries very, very hard. But ultimately, it's missing that thing that those other two screenwriters constantly bring to the subject. So The Founder, spoiler alert, presents us with an ambitious man who's not a very good person. Lather, rinse, repeat.
Right.
And it got a little tedious after a while. Although the early exposition scene where they sort of catch us up on how the McDonald brothers came up with is one of the best of those montages I've ever seen.
Yeah.
That's well done, and everyone tries really hard, and it's nice to see John Carroll Lynch getting work, and Nick Offerman is really good. But if I had to pick one film to define good, not great, I would pick The Founder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there anything to the fact that, like, I don't know, was there ever a time where that formula could have worked because of the way that it undermines this weird symbol of America that McDonald's has become? But now in 2017, none of us really think McDonald's is noble or good.
That's,
do you know what I mean?
That's an excellent point, because I think it was you a couple weeks ago who said that Life, which is coming out soon,
looks
like a film that was made in the 80s?
Like 2000. There are so many movies that look like they should have been made in the year 2000.
That if The Founder were made in the early 70s, when Ray Kroc was still alive, it would make people's heads explode.
Right.
It would be the apocalypse now of fast food.
Right.
I mean, really, because, wait, you weren't around yet.
No.
I was. The 70s was an interesting time, and it would not be out of place in that sort of pantheon of indie 70s films
right.
that we all sort of look up to and
right.
revere. It's just 47 years too late.
Right. Anything else?
No. Oh, I finally got a multi-region Blu-ray player
yes.
To work that actually works, and I've been trying to look at stuff that isn't available in the United States, and I was telling you that I finally got a hold of Dracula with the restored Japanese footage, and it's just sigh. Because I was among those kids reading Famous Monsters in the late 60s, early 70s, and every so often it was Famous Monsters who were floating, and you know, in Japan. And everyone thought Forrest J. Ackerman was full of shit because I love Forrest J. Ackerman, but he was frequently full of shit. And it was a rumor for so long. It was interesting when some of those finally come true. And the disc features two restorations that were done years apart by the BFI and then by Hammer. So that's interesting. Amazing little featurettes about the making of the film. Commentaries, and I'm slowly working my way through those.
And the extra footage amounts to about how much?
Oh, good Lord. You're going to laugh. It's basically two separate shots in the disintegration segment, although one of them is a showstopper. And then it's when Dracula is seducing one of the ladies. In the American version, it fades out. And in the racier Japan version, we get a reverse shot that really shows us what he's doing. Although, obviously, by 2017 standards, it's not.
Right. So it's basically those two shots.
It's basically three shots, probably totaling less than 30 seconds of film. So now we've brought you to the edge of the arcane. This is a land that we call Esoterica, from which no man survives.
Let me ask you this question as a collector. Bonus features aside, because it sounds like there's a lot of cool stuff. If you could have just watched those 30 seconds of footage on YouTube, here's what I've been missing my whole life. Would you still feel the need to import the Japanese version?
Well, I did do that.
Okay.
And it wasn't enough. I like to have it incorporated in the film.
Okay.
Plus, the restoration is the best.
Sure.
The best looking version of Dracula, as it is now correctly titled, because they went back, I think, some 16mm Buenos Aires print to get the original opening title. It's crazy. It stops being film and it becomes archaeology.
Right. Yeah, really.
Like what they went through with Metropolis.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I have three that I'll talk about very briefly. I don't know if this ended up getting talked about on the show last week. I don't think it did, because I talked about different movies in each version of the podcast we recorded. But I finally saw Swing Time. Turner Classic Movies had been running a couple of old Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies, and I had never seen one. So I saw Top Hat and I saw Swing Time, and so far those are the only two that I've seen.
This shows you how familiarity breeds. For decades, I had the poster for that film up in my living room.
Okay.
Good Lord.
It's delightful. What else am I going to say about it, really? It is a weird thing, though, because I had seen clips of Fred Astaire dancing, and you always hear about what a great dancer Fred Astaire was, but to actually watch it in the context of the movie, it's like watching Michael Jordan play basketball when Michael Jordan was playing basketball. You know, seeing it in the context of a game is totally different. I will say, it was a little jarring, the extended blackface number. I was like, oh, yikes. Okay. Oh. But again, historical context,
more
I guess.
More often than not, in so many of those Turner Classic Movies, you're watching and you're going along and it's so, wait, what are they doing?
Oh, life was so much simpler. Oh, shit, racism.
It's in so many of those films. Yeah. Now, I have a question for you, because all of the Astaire Rogers musicals blend together in my head
as
one film.
I could see that.
At one point, does he say he doesn't know how to dance and he takes a dancing lesson with Ginger Rogers?
That's the meet cute.
In front of her boss, he becomes, and it's take yourself off, dust yourself off, start all over again.
Sure.
That's the song. For years and years and years, on the thing that I used to teach basic film grammar, that was the example of long shot.
Okay.
Because Fred Astaire always said that you had to show the entire dancer.
Which makes a huge difference. And I think I liked Swing Time. I might have enjoyed Swing Time a little bit more than Top Hat, racism aside, just because I think it gives Ginger Rogers more to do.
Yeah.
And she's really, really terrific in that movie, and Top Hat doesn't give her as much to do. Top Hat, I would say, had the better dialogue, but whatever.
Top Hat usually gets the top spot for whatever reason. But
Okay. There's
something somewhere at home, I've got the box set of all of them.
Yeah.
Avoid the story of Irene and Vernon Castle.
Okay.
But other than that, I mean, they're great and they're very interchangeable.
Yeah, right. They're like beach party movies, basically.
Very much. But back in the 30s and 40s, the producers did not decide to give us a tiny Fred Astaire and a 10-foot tall Fred Astaire so that we could pick.
Got it. Got it.
Let's give them more Fred Astaire.
Just the regular model. I also saw, listening to last week's Pure Cinema podcast, they were talking about revenge films. And so I was on a little bit of a revenge kick, and I love revenge movies. So I saw one that I'd never seen. It's one of these Code Red titles called The Obsessed One from 1974. It's from a country called Suriname. It's a South American country that was like Dutch occupied. I was so it sent me down this crazy rabbit hole because I was like, I didn't even know this country existed.
I am flummoxed.
I'm a terrible human being. And the director is a guy named Ramjan Abdolrahman. I'm sure I said that wrong, and so my apologies. He really only ever made this one movie, wrote, directed, edited it. And it's one of these movies where you watch it and it's not good in the conventional sense, but it's like, yeah, but there's something here. A guy and his new bride are attacked by some ne'er-do-wells because they are playing with like these voodoo cards or tarot cards or something, and they turn one over that says sex and blood. And so they're like, oh, we have to kill and rape someone. So they do. And
the original title of
the wife is killed, and the husband is left for dead, but of course does not die. And so comes back to seek revenge. And it's real nasty. It's almost dialogue free. There's just this weird kind of funk score over the whole thing. It becomes hypnotic after a while. One of my favorite things is that the protagonist generally has curly hair, and yet every time he goes out, he puts on a disguise of a curly wig. he puts a wig on over hair that looks very much like the wig.
The curly hair is non-negotiable.
It's very strange.
It is my greatest feature. How did you come in possession of the film?
This is out on Blu-ray from Code Red.
Okay, it's out on Blu-ray, and I have never heard of the director. I've never heard of the film from your description. I've never heard of revenge. I feel like I'm in the dark. You know what it does remind me of, though? Many years ago, there was a theater in Chicago that showed Polish language films. And the exchange student from Poland was in my film study class. And what became a regular feature of class was I would get the newspaper back when people bought those, and it would list the two Polish language films they were showing, and he would translate the titles for the class. And every week, week after week after week, we noticed a pattern. Every title had something to do with sex and something to do with violence.
There you go.
So this translates to, my gun is very sexy tonight. Blood on your thigh. That no matter what order it was in, it's okay, now I see what the appeal is.
I would 100% see a movie called Blood on Your Thigh, as long as it wasn't like a film strip that they show in school about getting your first period.
But that's when they segregate the class,
right,
and the boys
exactly
go and watch not during sports season, and the girls see this other thing. I thought you meant you would see a film, a Polish language film called Blood on Your Thigh, as long as the thigh was mine. Literally.
Yeah,
you
yeah, saying, Blood on Your Thigh.
As opposed to yours.
Correct. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm not interested in that. Quick, total random side story. I was reading a book earlier today called The Horror of It All by Adam Rockoff, who has written some books about horror. He wrote Going to Pieces, The Rise and Fall of the Slasher Film. There's an anecdote in the book about going to dinner before the screening of The Wizard of Gore that you and I were at, going to dinner with Herschel Gordon Lewis, who's the nicest, happiest guy, but they're at a restaurant and some kid is being too loud, and Herschel Gordon Lewis turns around and lets the kid have it, and the author is waiting for it to turn out to be a joke, and he's like, but I don't think it is. I think he just was pissed off at that kid. And then he came to our theater and introduced that movie.
Because Herschel was of a generation where children should not behave that way in a
right,
restaurant.
Right.
And that was our screening.
Yep.
Of Wizard of Gore?
Correct.
My memory's fading. My memory is that Herschel Gordon Lewis was the music box for it is with the one with the hypnotist and
yeah,
oh, your
Wizard
hand
of
is
Gore
bleeding.
Concentrate.
Okay. Because I saw Herschel
But he
Gordon
led
Lewis
us in a sing-along of the theme song to 2000 Maniacs.
2000 Maniacs.
Correct.
Also, I have seen Herschel Gordon Lewis on more than one occasion, and one of the things that's still hanging proudly in my classroom, although it's probably coming down this week, is I have a an ad mat for for Blood Feast, and it is signed by David Friedman and Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Very cool.
Before both of them passed away.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite things, and kids don't know what it is, and I'm not allowed to explain it to them.
The last movie I'll talk about is a movie called Ruckus that I had never heard of before. It showed up because I watch some weird shit on YouTube sometimes. YouTube recommends other things to me. And so it says Ruckus, 1980. And I was like, all right, sure. So Ruckus is a movie from 1980 starring Dirk Benedict and Linda Blair. As it's a real just exploitation kind of a movie. He's a Vietnam vet who comes back, and the movie presents a Vietnam veteran. I mean, he's literally covered in dirt. He's almost feral. He doesn't talk. I mean, this is how they're presenting Vietnam vets. Comes back to a town with a bunch of rednecks who don't like him. They push him around. He gets in a fight. One of the rednecks gets hurt, and then they spend the rest of the movie chasing him and trying to murder him. And Linda Blair is kind of just the girl in town who gives him safe harbor. And
was this made after First Blood?
No, this predates First Blood.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it is the weird. I'm not recommending anyone see it, but it is just the weirdest movie because I'm watching it the whole time trying to get a sense of the movie's tone. Because on the one hand, it's an action movie because there's boats exploding, but it's that real A-team violence where no one dies. Right before the boat explodes, everyone jumps out of it and they jump into the water and then the boat explodes. So no one's ever actually getting hurt, just embarrassed. Linda Blair is in a different movie where her husband is off at war. She finds out in the course of the film, spoilers, that her husband is dead and is not coming home. And then there's all this weird comedy. All the scenes with the rednecks is all played with like dueling banjo music, and it's so broad. It's
at the beginning of the film, he doesn't have a black friend in Vietnam.
No.
He? Okay. I've talked about this before on the podcast. A trip downtown when I was in high school.
Are you talking about The Exterminator?
No.
Oh, okay.
Because I know The Exterminator, and I saw this Exterminator when I was in college.
Ah.
Made a special trip downtown to see that. But when I was in high school, we may have skipped class. I don't know. We went downtown to the late lamented McVickers Theater, Kung Fu Triple Feature.
Nice.
And it's me and my buddy, and I may have told this story before. There's two guys in Vietnam, and they're best buddies, and the black guy buys the farm, and the white guy goes back to the black neighborhood to say, your friend is dead, and I'm very, very sorry. And then it becomes this crazy revenge picture. And because we got very, very scared, it's like that scene in Animal House, that we were the only white people in the theater, I think we screamed and yelled and ran out of the theater. So I never got to finish it. I never found out what it was called. It's like my holy grail to find out what this movie is.
Someone
was.
Listening knows what this movie is.
Could it be
Ruckus? And they will list
Ruckus?
It in the comments. Sadly, it is not Ruckus.
No. And one day, the angel of the Lord will appear before me and tell me the name of the film and then tell me that's it.
Someone will know it in the comments, I promise.
Lights
Chaby. Out. Chaby will have it. Also, when you're casting sort of a grizzled Vietnam vet, I don't know if Dirk Benedict is the one that
you
turn to.
Well, the minute you said he's literally feral and covered with dirt, I'm like, how would Dirk Benedict allow that?
Don't worry. They clean him up about halfway. It's a weird movie. But
Ruckus.
It was just kind of cool to like, I've literally never heard of this movie, but
and
it's
this
got
is
some
on
people.
YouTube.
Yeah, it had some people that I knew, so I gave it a shot.
Is it less than 90 minutes or more than
It's about 90 minutes.
Minutes.
And it feels it. It took me maybe two sittings to get through the whole thing.
You had me at Linda Blair.
Anyway, oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Let's talk about Kong Skull Island, spoiler free, for a few minutes, and then we'll get into spoilers so we can talk specifics. Jay Bones, you and I both love the big monkeys.
Yes.
And we love monsters, and we love King Kong. Do we love Kong Skull Island?
I wanted to love this movie more than any other movie in a really long time.
Sure.
Because they opened the new ride in Florida. I've actually been on the ride before I saw the movie. The ride is terrific. I wanted to see it in IMAX. But it's not available IMAX 2D.
Right.
So I spent the extra money and the extra eye strain to see it in IMAX, that theater we love that has the old seats.
Right.
And I paid the extra money and I saw it in 3D.
How was the 3D?
On opening day.
Yeah.
And to be fair, the 3D is terrific.
Okay.
Clearly, it's converted. Is there any film anymore that's actually shot in 3D? Because in the end credits, there's endless 2D, 3D.
Right.
So it was converted.
Right.
But this gentleman who directed it with an eye toward it being shown in 3D.
Right. Because
there's a lot of stuff that really takes advantage of the 3D. And the 3D was fun and not obnoxious. The 3D honestly looked great and was fun.
Okay.
So there was that. I wanted to like it.
Yeah.
While it was unspooling, I was trying to enjoy it. I think there's things to like.
Sure.
In a weird way, it seemed like a response to our Godzilla podcast in that they filled the running time with narrative strands that we didn't care about and show us the monster more, and there's lots of Kong in Kong.
Yeah.
But there's not much else except for the scenes with Kong where Kong is doing something or fighting, and I think those might even get tedious because my wife was commenting that she's not the big monster fan that I am, and she thought those went on a little bit.
I mean, sure. I wonder how much of that had to do with I don't think the other monsters are very interesting.
No, although I give them some
which
credit.
Which is a dumb criticism.
For trying to come up with the skull racers.
Skull crawlers, right.
And there's one shot that I think is this film, given that this film shares a lot of things with the Godzilla reboot. Probably doesn't top it, but I just realized if I described it, we're in spoilers,
okay.
So I'll wait.
Okay.
Characters who are just one thing or barely one thing?
I think it's the barely one thing that I struggle with because I recognize we're not going to get complex characters in this movie. They don't necessarily need to be. They need to serve a function.
Right, but I thought about that in terms of the original Kong, and I would say that the human characters in the original King Kong aren't necessarily complex, but they are fleshed out much better than the characters in this film, which, if anything, suffers from too much characters. I think there's too many characters. And there's one point where there's two sets of characters that are separated, and they're separated for so long, it began to feel like two separate movies.
Yeah.
That were pasted together, or that they decided in the screen in the editing room, they would decide what narrative arc to favor.
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. I'm in the same boat as you. Unfortunately, I've been reading reactions online all weekend from people I know that love horror movies and monster movies, and they're very happy and excited, and this is a great big monster bash, and I'm happy for all those people. I wanted to like it more than I did, and it was interesting because I feel like overall I liked it. I don't want to say compare it to the Godzilla reboot. Did I like it more or less? I found them both unsatisfying in very different ways, which is fascinating.
Yes.
I think this one is probably more fun.
Yes.
Because it just has that tone. The Godzilla reboot was very kind of dour, and this isn't. But I think tone is actually one of the big problems of this movie. I think this movie is all over the place tonally.
No, I think you hit it, that if the Godzilla reboot was dour, this one desperately would like to be more gee whiz, but keeps bringing things up about which you cannot be gee whiz.
It's hard to do both.
If you want this to be a rousing adventure film, a popcorn movie, as they say, well, then the Vietnam allegory really kind of gets in the way. Also, how violent and mean-spirited some of it is.
Some of it, yeah. Definitely. I thought Kong was pretty cool. I mean, The design was, I think, a little bit more video gamey and cartoony than, say, the Peter Jackson reboot. That's okay. I thought a lot of his stuff was cool, and I think he's responsible for most of the moments that I liked. I thought his first appearance, which is given away in pretty much all the marketing in the trailers and even in the poster, but it's such a striking image of him standing against the sun and all that. All that stuff was really cool, I thought.
And then the film undercuts even that by having one of the soldiers say, "Is that a big monkey?"
Yeah, there's a few moments ADR,
Not to sidetrack us, but is there one single memorable line of dialogue in this film?
Well, so the screenplay, I feel like, is the movie's biggest weakness or undoing, because I thought in most ways it's actively bad. I think even the John C. Reilly character, who I think John C. Reilly and Sam Jackson come the closest to creating characters who we understand,
yes,
and who kind of stand apart. He's clearly kind of included as the comic relief, the Randy Quaid of this Independence Day stew. And yet I thought almost all of the lines he said that are meant to be funny fell flat for me. Other people find him a hoot. I just didn't think any of his stuff was funny. And again, it's so poorly timed because we just saw a human being ripped in half. And so maybe we don't need the joke right here. Or maybe we do. This movie can't quite decide.
It's as if the it's interesting that you say Samuel Jackson comes the closest to creating character and John C. Reilly does. That might have something more to do with their abilities as actors to work with nothing. But it's interesting you mention the two of them, because it's quite odd to have these two characters in the same movie.
Right. Because
they're from two different movies.
Right. And the two movies kind of get in the way of each other, because
yes,
what Sam Jackson is going through, but we'd be in spoilers.
Right.
Sam Jackson has a moment of no dialogue. He's just standing and glaring at King Kong, which I thought was great.
Well, I want to talk about that sequence.
Okay.
Because it's very odd.
Okay. So I guess we'll get into spoilers. We might as well now. Both of us, I think, were frustrated by the movie. And
you once said about certain films, when you watch them, you can see the different color pages. And clearly, this film must have gone through development hell, because it's three different movies going on at the same time. And maybe while they were shooting it, or maybe during test screenings, John C. Reilly tests through the roof. So
right,
we're going to use all of his stuff, including that thing at the end.
That was an insane choice.
So it's not just
no,
me, right?
Erica and I were sitting like, why is
that
this?
We have such.
Erica turned to me and said, what is this movie?
Was this just for the Chicagoland area? So the filmmakers feel that we're so invested in this character that this single character gets this strange Super 8 home movie epilogue, where the big question that we're all carrying around in our heads after watching a saga of an enormous ape, does this one guy get home?
Well, and again, it's from a different movie, and that's part of the problem, is that the movie can't quite decide what it's doing. So there were three screenwriters, I think. It might have been more. One of them is Dan Gilroy, who I know is a celebrated screenwriter and has written some good stuff. But maybe that's part of the problem, is that they're all contributing different movies. I don't even know if it's production hell, because I think the movie was kind of rushed into production.
That's the feeling I get.
And we'll talk about why in spoilers, because there's a very clear reason why the movie was rushed into production.
The John Goodman character gets the shortest shrift, and Goodman tries, but I think fails, because his storyline, in theory, could have possibly been the most interesting.
Well, he's Carl Denham, right?
That he's walking around knowing these monsters exist. So in a weird way, that part, if it worked, could have been much more like Jurassic Park, where it's the wonder
right,
of these
right,
beasts. And the point in the film, we're in spoilers now.
Yes, spoilers now for Kong Skull Island in 3, 2, 1.
The point in the film in which he is dispatched not only seems offhand, but did you only have him for 2 weeks? And the two, it just is ludicrous.
I can't decide. Okay, there's so many. We need to talk about this movie. There are so many things that I can't understand. Because in one way, the movie is very indifferent towards so many things that happen, including, is that a giant monkey? Okay, we're all over it. I mean, there's one person says, is that a giant monkey? And then everyone accepts it as the new reality. And there's no sense of like, this is crazy. There are giant monsters. There's a giant monkey trying to kill us.
It's what,
a lot of people are dying. We're all indifferent.
It's what you once described as, what was it, zookeeper phenomenon. You learn animals can talk, and the plot continues.
And then there's this weird indifference towards death. And I can't decide, is this a failure of screenwriting and filmmaking? Or is this the filmmaker, whose name is Jordan Vogt Roberts, and he's another one of these guys who is plucked from making a very small movie and handed a very big movie. And I'm always interested when that's announced, but I think now, by now, I'm going to be very cautious because we saw it with Gareth Edwards,
yes,
and Godzilla. We saw it with Kong Skull Island. We saw it with Colin Trevorrow and Jurassic World. I have yet to see it really work for me. People love those movies. That's fine.
But I think any of these directors may have had a vision in terms of what Orson Welles used to say was keeping the entire equation in your head. So one of the things you have to decide is what is the character's attitude towards these deaths, and what is the film's attitude toward these deaths? As I've often said, when you watch a Western, you can tell who the good guys and the bad guys are by how they react to someone dying. But when the studio perhaps makes suggestions and notes, that's torn asunder because we see some very violent, very shocking deaths. And then there are other characters who survive. And it's like, well, I guess those are the lucky ones. And the film is so cavalier about violent death, we then begin to wonder why Samuel L. Jackson's motivation at one point is to go back for one of these guys who he feels is alive. It's odd.
Well, so I couldn't understand, is the randomness of the death part of the movie trying to function as Vietnam allegory? Because there's a moment where a character attempts to sacrifice himself, which is completely arbitrary, and it's just like, we don't know what else to do with this guy. And we see this scene in every movie where the character straps himself with grenades and waits for the monster to attack him and then blows himself up to take out as many of the monsters as possible. And in Kong Skull Island, it's a spectacular failure.
And leaves you scratching your head because that character is set up, again, in a very confusing manner. On the way home, my wife and I were discussing his monologue about taking the villager's rifle and using the villager's rifle.
Yes.
What on earth did that mean? What does that mean? This is more effective at killing them. I was going to show them who's boss. I like throwback weapons. It's a yeah. fairly long speech in
yeah.
the film.
Yeah.
He's the one who's going to do it. And then for some insane reason, his heroic attempt to sacrifice himself
right.
is...
And right, so is this the movie, again, painting Vietnam as kind of this clusterfuck in every way? If it is, interesting, doesn't work. You know, for me, like you said, I think Jordan Vogt Roberts has ideas. I think he has something that he's trying to execute. I just don't think it works on a number of levels, not just a storytelling level, but I felt like we're jumping all over the place here, and I apologize. But even the editing of the film, to me, is at times rushed.
Yes.
And then at times he keeps doing speed ramping and slow motion. And
for no clear purpose.
Right, right. And drawing things out where I was like, I can't believe I'm still watching this sequence. I mean, there's even a scene, the Toby Kebbell character that they want to go back for, we've seen randomly murdered, even though we've set up he's the guy with the kid, and we want him to get home. we're told he's a great soldier and they all love him the most. We don't ever get to see that represented. We just have other
writing
characters
a letter,
tell it. Right.
And that's a thing.
And so we want him to get home, so fuck you, and he dies violently. But then we have to wait as they look for him, and then we have to wait as Tom Hiddleston sees his dog tags, and then we have to wait for him to tell Sam Jackson, and then we have to watch the scene where they all mourn him, all information that we've had for 15 minutes now. It's filled with weird choices like that.
And one could argue that saying, I'm making a King Kong film, and Kong is an allegory for Vietnam, is an idea that could work. It doesn't work here for a number of reasons. This seems to be Kong as an allegory for Vietnam films. Because Vietnam was so long ago, it's not as if you're bringing up Vietnam in a movie for the first time. It almost seemed like a demented version of the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack that clearly any movie about Vietnam
Suicide
is going to have 60s songs blaring. And this reaches its nauseating apotheosis when for the 87th time in American film history, they play Creedence's Run Through the Jungle. Yeah. And you just want to punch the screen.
It's Erica again turned to me and said, like, this is like Suicide Squad with these music choices that are so on the nose. And you're right that it's a movie about Vietnam movies because it's so steeped in the songs and the visual iconography. And remember, even the marketing is Apocalypse Now. Everything is.
And for people with half a brain, there's little things like the character's
name.
Yeah. Oh, and that's okay. Wow.
But Kong himself, I don't think even works as the metaphor for Vietnam, because Skull Island itself is the metaphor for Vietnam, right? This is the terrain with which we are unfamiliar.
Yes.
And John C. Reilly, you don't understand where you are. Everything can kill you here. It doesn't play by your rules. All this stuff, right? Kong is the thing that ultimately protects them and guards Skull Island. So what is Kong in this allegory?
And here's the better metaphor, and I don't mean to get political.
No, okay.
But in Logan...
It's happening, everyone.
In Logan, we were wondering if there were reshoots or some ADR, because there's that sequence with the wall that seems awfully today.
Oh, okay.
The Mexican border wall in the future.
Right.
Where when did this have to be shot? And there's a similar scene in Kong Skull Island where John Goodman gets out of the car and says something like, I remember when Nixon was the most screwed up thing in Washington.
Right.
Hardy har har.
Right.
But then we go to a place full of people who don't look like the rest of us, and this place has a wall.
Right.
And we know that Samuel Jackson is gung-ho to kill this thing, but as it turns out, this thing can help us. So maybe that should have been the allegory from 2017, not from 1967.
Right. I mean, the movie has been gestating, I think, only for like 2 years, but that wall conversation has been going on for a few years. So even if it was pre-election, it's
because
been
even
talked about.
Even discarding Vietnam, which this film should have done, the idea of the outsider, which Kong has always been,
right,
that Kong is the other, I think would have been a better allegory. As it stands, we get the photographer storyline with Tom Hiddleston.
Please. Anti-war photographer.
Oh, of course.
That's all we know about her.
And they're okay, because they like Kong and they don't want to kill Kong, and they're the two most attractive people in the film. Although I will give the film credit for this. There's no love scene.
Right.
Way to go.
Right.
And at one point I thought they were going to go for the Fay Wray thing where Kong...
They kind of do.
But not to the extent that any of the other Kong films do.
No.
I was happy that they didn't go down that path.
Sure.
Because then the movie would have been four different things competing with each other.
I thought there was enough of it. I mean, without explicitly just remaking that storyline, I think there was enough of it that it was like, oh, okay, that's what this is.
Yes, the weakest point in the... Peter Jackson film, which I like to call Kong on Ice.
I like that movie, and I like it better than this movie.
I like parts of Peter Jackson's film. I think he actually stumbled because he is so in love with
Kong
that he's going to do his dream version of Kong. The fight in the vines with the dinosaurs, that's just the most amazing thing.
Yeah.
It's the greatest thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, I know it's super long and bloated and people are like, oh, it's endless. And for me, because I liked it, I'm like, hey, more to love. You know, like I'm happy.
I love the vines. You know, Buster Keaton would be proud. And also him bringing to fruition the scene that was cut from the original Kong with
right.
the big bugs in
right.
the ravine. Way to go. And you've seen
his recreation. Yeah.
It's something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, oh, I miss that.
Can we go
Peter
back
Jackson.
To Samuel Jackson's eyes?
Yes. Let's.
There is a sequence where Kong is standing there, and Kong does not look happy, and he's very upset. And he's glaring at Samuel Jackson, who is likewise not very happy, and he's upset. And it's mano a mano. And they frame the shot very tightly, so it's Kong's eyes and nose, and it's Samuel Jackson's eyes and nose. And at this point, I start to feel ooky. Because one of the sub-themes of King Kong has always been that Kong represents the black man. There's a famous essay about the original Kong. I can never remember the name of it, but that is the allegory of the original 30s Kong.
Right.
That Carl Denham's girl ran away with a black man.
Right.
So you have to notice that there's a lot of things in common with those two shots. And I'm wondering, would this be less racist or more racist if the army guy was white?
Mm.
It's just the strangest sequence.
I see the point you are making, and at the same time, none of that occurred to me. So I don't want to say we are now post-racial because it didn't occur
well, no,
to me.
But it might clearly be baggage that I'm bringing to the film. It's just so odd.
Yeah. And again, is this right after Kong attacks and kills everyone?
I think it is after a prolonged period of violence for Kong.
So that was the moment for Samuel Jackson that I liked, where he's just standing and glaring at Kong, and it's in that moment that you realize, like, oh, his new goal in life is to kill Kong. And I just thought it was effective. The Samuel Jackson character is problematic. I hate using that word, but because I can't understand the movie's position on him, because ultimately he ends up becoming the villain.
Yeah.
And yet he's a soldier who goes there because he's assigned to go. And so he does it. And he is angry and upset that his men were killed.
I think it goes beyond he was assigned, though, because clearly,
well, he was anxious to go.
His first scene shows that he has nowhere else to go, and he's
right.
very happy.
And
to
so
have
he's it. Anxious to go back, and he gets that scene where he says, "We didn't lose that war. You know,
we abandoned it.
It's so on the nose." But like, okay, from where this character is coming from, that is an in-character thing to say. And when he is reunited with his soldiers, it's a very genuine moment where he's hugging them, and he's legitimately happy to see them, and is a good person in that regard. And then by the end of the film, we want him to be the enemy because John C. Reilly has said, well, you can't kill Kong. He's here to protect it. Leave him alone. And Sam Jackson actually has a line where he says, it's my job. Like, people shouldn't even know that exists. And while I don't agree with him trying to kill Kong, I think there's something to what that character is saying. And I say this not as somebody who is, you know, a warmonger or anything, but I thought that's an interesting point of view for this guy to have, and one that I don't think is inherently villainous.
But which the film fails to develop.
But he's the bad guy.
So what we get is we do not have developed characters, nor do we have completely cardboard characters. So it's this weird bastard hybrid of parts that are underwritten, actors who are much better than their material, leading you to a moment like that.
Because I think in so many movies, you and I would be saying, hey, isn't it great that there's some ambiguity there, and this guy is the villain, but also, in his own eyes, right. Would I be happier if the movie had just made him generic warmonger, we gotta kill everyone? And instead, it's this weird in-between, which I'm not saying is a failure, but just is so much of this movie, which can't quite pick a lane.
It is the in-between. So it's not deliberate ambiguity on the part of the filmmaker. It's just confusing.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of the movie, unfortunately, is that it's tonally, it's confusing. We have comedy and action and horror and war allegory kind of mixed together in ways that, again, I'm all for a movie that can balance a lot of tones, but I don't think this movie balances them. I think it shifts on a scene-by-scene basis.
Yeah.
And the moment where I just saw today on Twitter, you know, Tom Hiddleston, I don't follow him, somebody retweeted this, where Tom Hiddleston said, you know, when I signed on to do this movie, Jordan Roberts showed me this picture of me running through this fog or something with a samurai sword and a gas mask, and you know, in theaters now you get to see us, we've created that. I don't remember the wording, but it was like that this was some iconic moment of him running with the gas mask through the poison gas with the sword, and it got a laugh from me, you know, and maybe that's just me being cynical or something, but I just thought the way that moment was handled didn't feel badass, in part because, again, it's something that he chooses to put in slow motion. To me, it just felt like a swing at badass that completely missed and came off silly.
Plus, I was confused, and I would argue this is the film's fault, that all that smoke, is that something that they create to confuse the enemy and give them an advantage? Or was that smoke something like Agent Orange or something, which is why he needs the gas mask?
Right.
I wondered what the smoke was other than a visual element that made it look really cool.
It was, yeah.
It's like a 12-year-old. I'm running in slow motion through smoke, and I'm wearing a gas mask, and I'm wielding a samurai sword. Right. It's like a 12-year-old's fantasy of an action movie.
So let's, I don't want to like jump to the end of our conversation, but I kind of want to jump to the end because the movie seems reverse engineered because it's essentially just a remake of King Kong. They've reconfigured certain things, the reason that they're going to the island and the time period in which it is set. You know, instead of a filmmaker, John Goodman is a guy who believes monsters. He's a conspiracy theorist, basically.
And he's from a company called Monarch, which I feel we'll be seeing again.
And he turns out to be right. And Faye Ray is now an anti-war photographer. Maybe there are a lot of photographers who describe themselves as anti-war photographers. I don't know. So it's essentially just a remake of King Kong, but I feel like all the scenes to get us to the island are not particularly interesting and there to set up characters who then are sort of abandoned character-wise once they get there. Tom Hiddleston, you're the rogue and the tracker. You're the romantic lead because you play pool and you demand some money, and then once he gets there, it's just you're just another guy on the island.
And if I could just interject, he has this story about carrying his father's lighter.
Oh, I forgot about the lighter that we knew would come back.
Which Brie Larson sort of gleefully, clearly it's in the service of surviving, but after the film gives him this monologue, it's sort of thrown away, and it made me think, in Pulp Fiction, what if after the Butch thing, Maria Medeiros had been just, oh no, I threw it in the street.
Right. If there were giant monsters, though,
do you
maybe
still like my pouch?
Bruce Willis would have been more forgiving. Again, the way that moment was handled, I felt was embarrassing, in part because it was slowed down, and Brie Larson, who I love, didn't always seem comfortable with the special effects. We'll see. I don't know, but even that story that he gets about searching for his father doesn't really play out a few minutes later when it's like, well, we got to go find Toby Kebbell. And he's like, there's not that beat where he says, okay, yeah, like we shouldn't leave a man behind because of my whole thing with my father. We don't actually get that played out. Maybe it's implied enough that I'm asking for the movie to be too much on the nose.
But his other
but then it's so on the nose when she throws the lighter. Remember the lighter?
His other monologue to Goodman and company about how dangerous it is and all the different ways to die sets him up as someone who, once he gets there, assesses what's going on and says, no, we're not going for him. We're doing this.
Right.
because he realizes the full danger of where they are.
Which he does sort of do, again, later in the film when he says, okay, Sam Jackson, you take your guys. I'm going to lead the civilians to the boat, and we'll meet up with you. I thought, yeah, that's a compromise that makes sense, and everyone's okay with it. There would be flashes of things where I'm like, okay, I'm on board for that. And the random scientist dude, though.
Well, again, we're in spoilers. Goodman's assistant, who's...
I'm not even talking about that guy. I'm talking about the guy that Sam Jackson says, like, are you a man or a pussy?
In that blue uniform.
Yeah.
That too, seemed to be either something that was larger that hit the cutting room floor or something that's going to pay off, that everything's a shared universe now.
Well,
and if people will go to one movie, let's make them go to five. So here's where the film shoots itself in the foot about that. I like to stay through the credits for a number of reasons.
Oh, I know exactly what you're going to
say. First of all, it sets me up as a pretentious asshole who won't let them clean the theater. By the way, at the end of Logan, they were really tight for time because Logan's a little longer and they scheduled the screenings really close. The cleanup crew barges into the theater the minute the last line of dialogue is spoken and shout, "There's nothing at the end! There's none of those things."
Wow.
And proceed to clean the theater. So now we're sitting through the end credits of Kong Skull Island because at the very least, I've come to think I like hearing the music playing through big speakers.
Right.
And suddenly there's a credit for something that we haven't seen.
Right.
This, and this courtesy of what?
Which Erica missed, but which I saw. But I kind of already knew. I hadn't read any spoilers. Going into the theater, our ticket seller said, make sure you stay through the credits. And I knew what was coming.
And it was poorly done.
Agreed.
And not enough to warrant you staying there. And it's basically a slap in the face and the film shouting, see you in 2 years. And then in my theater, I got an extra scene, a gentleman in a Famous Monsters t-shirt. The film is literally over.
Yeah.
Exhorting those of us who are left to come to G-Fest in Rosemont in July. He was shouting out.
Did he like the movie?
For G-Fest. I felt he did.
Okay.
Because again, remember, after the Godzilla reboot, Adam Riske and I attended G-Fest and specifically sat through a discussion session about the new Godzilla movie. And all of the dyed-in-the-wool Godzilla fans love the movie. Do you remember this? Because it had Godzilla in it.
Well, and I want to come back to this idea of are we being assholes? But let's talk about this end credits scene because it's so cynical. And it's so, of course, you and I are going to be excited if they're doing Destroy All Monsters. Of course, we're going to go opening weekend, right? Of course we are. We're the audience for that movie. But this is everything now. Everything is the coming attraction for the next thing.
And what really got me upset driving home was they seem to be setting up the possibility of a reboot of Godzilla versus King Ghidorah and Godzilla versus Mothra. And I'm far less interested in those movies than perhaps seeing a remake of King Kong meets Godzilla, which on the surface, which based on the evidence that this Easter egg gives us, is many films down the road.
Yeah, I can't tell if that's...
I don't see Kong in any of those cave paintings or whatever it was.
Right, he's not the only king or whatever the stupid line of dialogue is. I couldn't tell based on that. Are they shared universing it? Where just
the roar at the end seems to be Godzilla.
Godzilla,
yeah,
right. And we have the Godzilla sequel already in development, not yet being shot, but Michael Dougherty is directing it of Krampus and Trick or Treat fame. So listen, you got somebody good on board. I'm in. But
hey, we met him.
That's right.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. I couldn't tell based on that, okay, is Kong part of that mix or not? But just why is this the model now? Why is everything the Avengers? Why is everything, how do we make a shared universe out of this? Which is why I think Kong Skull Island was essentially rushed into production. It was, hey, we got to make a shared universe of these giant monsters.
It's McDonald's with the Big Mac.
Yeah.
Why sell people one movie where you can sell them five?
Right. And I don't think that the movie... I didn't feel necessarily like, okay, I just wasted my time because they didn't even try to make a movie. All they made was a coming attraction for the next thing, which we have seen in some of these franchise attempts to launch a franchise, you know. But we live in a time now where it's like we're so anxious to get to the meetup that we rush the lead up, right. Not to Johnny Cochran that shit, but like we got to make a Justice League movie. All right, well, we made Man of Steel. Let's do Batman v Superman, throw them all in, and then Justice League next. Like we can't, there's no delayed gratification.
But that also gives you something to fall back on. If people say this wasn't good, you're like, but wait, because that's what, and I think I'm getting, you said this on an earlier podcast. It's like, but wait for the next one, and our reaction is, well, why can't this one be good?
Right. And I think they tried with this one. I'm not so cynical as to say...
The marketing strategy is third time's a charm.
I mean, with some of this stuff, it really does seem to be. I don't think... I'm not so cynical as to say, hey, they didn't even try with Kong Skull Island. They're just there to, you know, set up the next one. I didn't love the movie... But I don't think, I think it tried to be its own thing that then at the end has this Easter egg. But, and this is all coming from a kind of a corporate studio level. This isn't the filmmakers, but right. Just that's so much of what is driving filmmaking now are corporate studio decisions. And we can't just get a good King Kong movie. And then if there's a desire for it, okay, well, we own these two things, let's do King Kong versus Godzilla. It's like we got to rush to remake Kong so that we can make King Kong versus Godzilla, which is what people are interested in. It's like, no, I just want to see the King Kong movie, right? But this exists essentially so that they can do Kong versus Godzilla, because first we have to introduce Kong for 2017 audiences. We can't just do
And I kept thinking that John Goodman's assistant, the guy with the glasses, and yes, the Asian scientist,
who is there for overseas
here.
Ticket sales.
Well, and that's the first thing I thought, but then I thought,
which
well,
is horrible. I'm happy to see an Asian character on screen, but like with three lines of dialogue, she's the pilot in Independence Day Resurgence. It's
but
like
because she has so little to do, and given the material in the Easter egg, oh, these two are going to be a bigger part. So again, it's place setting.
It just smacks of. That sounds cynical to me, and I apologize, but like that to me smacks of tokenism in such a way where it's like, why not give one of these larger roles to an Asian actor? And there is one of the soldiers appears to be, I think he's Filipino, possibly.
Right, but that's a slap in the face to her. It's literally
right.
A nothing
right,
role.
Right.
It's like a contest winner
right.
Was taken to Vietnam, stand here and look very surprised.
Which I would think very little of. If I didn't know that the new model is we got to sell tickets
yes.
In China, you know. So are we just being assholes? Because people want to go watch giant monsters fight. And this movie has a lot of giant monsters fighting. And I do not want to deny anyone that fun. Why didn't we have more fun?
Because we want it to be a movie, not just when you look at a wedding ring, you're looking at the diamond, and I think that's the monsters fighting, but you don't want it to be, oh, wait, the setting of the ring is pieces of a shrimp cocktail that someone, oh, it's not metal, it's like this. These shrimp shells have been fashioned into something that will hold the diamond. The monster fighting is good. I honestly thought the film was making an attempt to outdo the one shot in the Godzilla reboot
right.
That I've talked about endlessly, right. What you call the atomic kiss.
Right.
I don't know if it's worth the price of admission, but when Kong solves the problem of that thing's long tongue, I was like, wow. But that was my original reaction to Godzilla. What if the entire movie could be that thought out
right.
and that new?
Right. And I don't know that I thought anything in Kong Skull Island was as triumphant as that moment in Godzilla, but maybe that's just the big gulp in the desert phenomenon, which is like, you've given us nothing, now here's something, and we're all excited, whereas Kong has a lot more of it spread out throughout the film.
And make no mistake, I sat there, it had been a long week at work, I wanted to love this film so badly. Especially because, and I think I brought this up at the beginning, the ride in California is part of the studio tour, and that's been there forever, and the tram pulls into this big soundstage, and you put on your 3D glasses, and Peter Jackson's people did it, and it's fun. But in Florida, they've re-engineered it, so it's a ride unto itself, where you get into a truck, and you go on this expedition, and like every other ride at Universal, something goes horribly wrong. Someone once wrote an essay for Slate, where the premise was they were being ironic, like they were a tourist who didn't know how this thing worked. And they were like doing a Yelp review of Universal Studios, and they kept saying, well, too many of the rides break down. I went on the Simpsons ride, and it's supposed to be this wonderful thing, but then Sideshow Bob grows to an and something, and I went on the Jurassic Park ride, and it's supposed to be a nice boat ride, but then something goes horribly wrong. All the rides are broken. But, spoiler alert, the Kong ride in Florida is my new favorite thing. For a number of reasons, I was able to go on it again and again, which was fun. And as a nod to the original Kong ride, which you told me about your adventure with that.
Yes.
The original cable car Kong ride.
Right, right, right.
After the truck and the screens and the 3D glasses and spritzing you with water, because every goddamn ride spritzes you with water. At the end of the Florida ride, there is a full-size animatronic Kong.
That's awesome.
As a little cherry on the sundae. And it's
that
like,
is, that's awesome.
Oh, it's so yeah. great to see that again. And it's my new favorite ride.
Cool. This is, unfortunately, and I feel bad saying this, it's a frustrating movie in so many ways. I think it has a bad script. And I think it's directed, unfortunately, with a lot of tonal inconsistencies, even though I can see this is a filmmaker who's trying.
But if you sat there with a stopwatch,
yeah.
Now my question becomes just the most mercenary, what percent of the movie are these characters and plot strands that we don't think are well done, and how much of the movie is big monsters fighting?
Right.
And is there enough of the big monsters fighting to warrant going? Because when big monsters were fighting, I was having a hell of a time.
Sure. But you can't have a movie that's just big monsters fighting, right? And I, to me, I don't think you can. And so then the problem becomes...
Well, hold off. I don't mean to be devil's advocate.
No, that's fine.
Do you remember the first Raid movie?
Yeah.
And there's characters and character development in that film. But right. you'll admit it's...
It's mostly fighting.
What if you had a King Kong movie like that? We are a special expedition force. Go!
And listen, maybe that will be when they do Destroy All Monsters, or you know, we'll see. I don't know. I'm annoyed by the. It's like I'm so conflicted because on the one hand, I'm annoyed by the kind of bullshit mercenary decision that goes into it. Pandering to me. Like,
yeah.
I'm the one who's being pandered to, and I resent it.
And they
You're
did,
getting everything you want, and you hate us for it, asshole.
They did do less plot than in Godzilla. There's
yeah,
far
yeah,
less.
Yeah, yeah.
There's far less of the monsters fighting in the background
right.
where there's foreground dramatic action we don't care about.
And again, that was a filmmaker trying to do something. Again, I don't think it worked, but had an idea. This filmmaker has an idea. I'm not thrilled with the execution of either, but okay. I will say, and I put this on Twitter last night, unfortunately, of the four main King Kong versions, this is my least favorite.
I have to think about it.
Okay.
Because
I rank them.
I have big problems with Jackson.
Yeah.
Obviously, I have big problems with the 70s one.
Yeah.
No problem whatsoever with the original.
Obviously.
What can you do? I feel that like the Godzilla podcast and the Interstellar podcast, people will like this podcast because people secretly hate themselves. And they're going to cozy up to their little device that they use to download the podcast, and they're going to say, I like this film, John. Tell me that I'm wrong. I like it so much when you tell me the 100 ways I'm wrong.
But it, no one is wrong for liking
it
this.
It hurts so good when I'm shown the... No, I'm just joking around. And I hope I conveyed this. I am conflicted.
Yeah.
I'm not condemning this film. Right. I'm condemning parts of this film. I think parts of this film work.
Sure.
But because other parts do not, it's frustrating.
Yes, absolutely. And again, when the lines that everyone is speaking are so bad, it really steps on the movie succeeding, I think.
Is there one memorable line?
No, but I think there are others that are actively terrible,
yes,
and that's the problem.
Very clunky.
If it was just generic, that's one thing, but to be so bad... I put that out on Twitter last night, and our friend Josh Perlman said, you know, I thought it was a ton of fun. And I said to him the same thing I said to you after Independence Day Resurgence. I can't argue with fun. You know, if somebody has fun with this movie, awesome.
Yes, and I have to go back because that's become my bete noir now. I would like to go back and listen to what I said.
You said you had fun. You said it's a bad movie that you had fun with.
That's all I said.
Exactly. Right. No, nobody can argue with that. That's what I mean. You can't argue with fun.
Here's what I think. Not that I mean to belabor this. Because my expectations were so high, this film did not meet them. I had no expectations for Independence Day and wound up enjoying it. In a weird way, expectations aside, I think I may have liked the two movies the same amount for the same reasons.
All right.
Would you admit that King Kong Skull Island is a better film than Independence Day Resurgence?
Yes, I would.
Okay, I thought I could get you to
say
that.
Yes, I would.
You know what was funny? After a day or a week, I stopped reading the comments on things.
Okay.
Because, you know, life intrudes.
Right.
And I went back and read some comments that were left quite a bit of time after Independence Day Resurgence.
Okay.
And people were writing things that were either so funny or so touching. Someone was really getting mad about how mean you were.
I don't think I was mean. I was mean to the movie. I wasn't mean to you.
And a couple people said, I'm with JB.
Yeah, right.
And when people say that, my reaction is, then I'm wrong.
Anyway, as always, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter at fthismovie. We're on Facebook. We're on Stitcher. We're all over the place. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Jay Bones, for talking Skull Island with me.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.